Before we get into Braid, quick note on Impulse, our other daily show. It tracks how AI is changing markets and institutions, along with labor, science, medicine, geopolitics, robotics, media, education, and the open versus closed model fight. If Braid is the builder's table, Impulse is the wider room around it. You can find it at the Impulse page on braid.opentangle.com, linked in the show notes. Okay. OpenAI announced the OpenAI deployment company today, and the announcement isn't subtle about what OpenAI thinks the next enterprise bottleneck is. The company says it's launching a majority-owned, OpenAI-controlled business that exists to help organizations build and deploy AI systems across their important work. It has agreed to acquire Tomorrow, an applied AI consulting and engineering firm, which gives the new company about 150 forward-deployed engineers and deployment specialists on day one. It also has 19 partners around it, investment firms, consultancies, and systems integrators. TPG is leading the partnership. Advent, Bain Capital, and Brookfield are co-lead founding partners, and OpenAI says the company will launch with more than $4 billion of initial investment. That is the factual part. OpenAI isn't just saying, here are better models, good luck wiring them into your procurement system and your field operation and your audit process. It's saying, we are going to own a company whose job is to put engineers inside those organizations and help change the work. The official copy says, these engineers will connect OpenAI models to customer data, tools, controls, and the business processes people use every day. It also says they will work with business leaders, operators, and frontline teams. The goal is to identify where AI can make the biggest impact, redesign critical workflows around it, and turn those gains into durable systems. I think OpenAI is doing two things at once here. First, it's trying to capture more of the enterprise value chain. That part is plain. If the model is only a component, then a lot of the money and a lot of the customer learning goes to the people who turn the component into something a business can use every day. Second, OpenAI is admitting, in public, that deployment isn't a thin wrapper around a chat box. The expensive work is getting the model close enough to the actual business to help, while keeping it away from the places where a bad answer can hurt people or break a process. There is a Palantir flavor here, because forward-deployed engineering is a very particular style of business. You send technical people into messy organizations. They learn the local nouns. They build against real data and old processes. They turn demos into operating systems for a team. That can be extremely powerful, and it can also make the vendor very sticky. If your AI workflows are designed by a company majority owned by OpenAI, and those workflows are built to improve as OpenAI's models and tools come online, you aren't buying a neutral adapter layer. You are buying into a path. I don't mean that as a dunk. For a lot of companies, that may be exactly what they want. Most enterprise AI projects aren't blocked because nobody can write the prompt. They are blocked because the data is weird and the permissions are weird. People don't trust the outputs yet. The legal team wants a record, and the team that owns the process often isn't the team that owns the model budget. A forward-deployed engineer can help, because the job is mostly translation between a capable system and a human organization that has 20 years of scar tissue. The builder angle is simpler. Model capability isn't the product by itself. The product includes the model. It also includes the deployment path, evals, permissions, user experience, and the maintenance story after everyone stops calling it a pilot. OpenAI's announcement is a corporate move, sure. Underneath that, it's also a technical claim. The Frontier Labs think the next serious contest is who can make intelligence usable inside ordinary work without losing control of the details. Daniel Stenberg, the lead developer of Curl, published a useful post today about running Anthropic's Mythos model against Curl. The title is almost the whole attitude. Mythos finds a Curl vulnerability. Singular. One. Back in April, Anthropic drew a lot of attention to Mythos and its security work. Daniel was offered access through the Linux Foundation and Alpha Omega path for open source projects. Access didn't arrive directly, so eventually, someone who had access ran the scan for him and sent the report. That report analyzed curl's Git repository, specifically the source and library directories. The scan covered about 178,000 lines of code. Daniel gives a lot of context here that matters. Curl isn't a random weekend library. He says curl is about 176,000 non-blank lines of C, 660,000 words installed in more than 20 billion instances, running on more than 110 operating systems and 28 CPU architectures. He also says the project had already been scanned by several AI-powered tools, including Izel, ZeroPath, and OpenAI's Codex Security. Those tools had already triggered somewhere between 200 and 300 bug fixes across the last 8 to 10 months. So Mythos wasn't walking into untouched ground. It was walking into a codebase that has years of fuzzing, conventional analyzers, careful compilers, human review, and AI review. A security team takes reports seriously, too. The Mythos report claimed 5 confirmed security vulnerabilities. After Daniel and the curl security team worked through the list, 5 became 1. 3 were false positives around documented API behavior. 1 was just a bug. 1 was a confirmed vulnerability, planned as a low-severity CVE for curl-21.0 in late June. The report also had about 20 non-security bugs that were described well and are being investigated. That is a much more interesting outcome than either side of the argument usually wants. If you want the most dramatic possible AI security story, 1 low-severity CVE in curl after all that hype falls short. Daniel's personal conclusion is that the hype around this model was mostly marketing, at least from this one repository. But if you want the anti-AI story, the post doesn't give you that either. Daniel says AI-powered analyzers are significantly better than old-style analyzers at finding security flaws and mistakes in code. He says modern AI models are good at this now, and projects that haven't scanned their source with AI-powered tooling will likely find a lot of flaws. He's using them as part of the work. The line I keep coming back to is very plain. AI reviews are used in addition to human reviews. They help, they don't replace the humans. Then Rival Security added a second piece of context on a different Mythos security claim, and this one is about provenance. Anthropic had discussed CVE-2026-4747, a free BSD network file system remote code execution issue as part of the Mythos story. Rival went looking at the history and argued that the vulnerable FreeBSD function is closely related to old MIT Kerberos code that had a very similar bug, CVE-2007-3999, patched back in 2007. The comparison in their write-up is direct. A fixed stack buffer receives the RPC header fields, then a credential body gets copied without a bounds check. The new FreeBSD fix and the old Kerberos patch even rhyme structurally. Rival's conclusion isn't that the finding is useless. Their point is that the discovery may be closer to combinatorial reuse of something represented in training data than to a wholly new bug class. I think that distinction matters, but not in the cheap way. If an AI system can rediscover a 2007 bug pattern in FreeBSD and then help exploit it, the provenance question doesn't make the operational problem disappear. Attackers don't need philosophical novelty. They need a path from code to exploit. Defenders need a path from old code to fix. The curl post and the rival post together put the Mythos story at a reasonable altitude. We aren't looking at magic vulnerability omniscience. We're also not looking at a toy. These systems can scan huge amounts of code and explain candidates. They can find ordinary but dangerous patterns and produce reports maintainers can act on. They also overstate. They call things confirmed before the maintainers confirm them. They rediscover old shapes. they need human review, and in the best cases, they make that review more productive. For builders, the practical answer is process, not fear. If you maintain a serious code base, AI security review is becoming normal toolchain work. You still need fuzzing and tests. You still need static analysis, compiler warnings, and maintainers who know the code. But it's getting harder to justify never running an AI analyzer, because the people looking for bugs from the outside are absolutely going to run one. James Shaw published an essay with a line that should be taped above every coding agent adoption plan. Your AI coding agent needs to reduce your maintenance costs. He isn't arguing that agents can't make you faster. He's arguing that speed by itself is the wrong number to optimize. Every month of code you add creates future work. Bugs need fixes, dependencies need upgrades, design mistakes need repair, and the software has to stay alive after the feature lands. His model is intentionally simple. Imagine a team spends a month writing code, and in the following year, that month of code costs 10 days of maintenance, then 5 days every year after that. The exact numbers matter less than the shape. As the code base grows, more and more of the team's time goes into keeping old work usable. In his example, after 2.5 years, more than half the time is maintenance. After 10 years, there's barely room for new work. Now put a coding agent into that model. If the agent doubles your output, but the code costs the same to maintain per unit, you have doubled the future maintenance work. If the code is harder to understand, or the team stops reading diffs carefully because there are too many of them, the bill gets worse. Shaw's cleanest claim is arithmetic. If you produce twice as much code, the code needs to cost half as much to maintain. If you produce 3 times as much, it needs to cost 1/3 as much. Otherwise, the speed up decays, and then it turns on you. That could sound abstract, except the K10S devlog gives the concrete version. The author built a GPU-aware Kubernetes terminal UI across 7 months, 234 commits, and around 30 weekends, heavily using Claude. The project started with a clear niche, something like K9S for people running NVIDIA clusters, with GPU utilization and DCGM metrics in a purpose-built interface. It also tracked idle nodes, temperature, power draw, and memory. Early on, it felt amazing. It gained pod and node views, then deployments and services. It also gained a command palette, live updates, and Vim key bindings. Then the fleet view arrived, and it looked good. After that, switching back to pods broke. Live updates stopped, tables showed stale data, tab counts went wrong. The author finally read the code. The central model file was 1,690 lines. One state object held third-party UI widgets and the Kubernetes client. It also held current resources and watches, logs, describe views, navigation history, mouse handling, fleet state, cached rows, raw objects, layout details, and a lot more lived there too. The update function was about 500 lines with more than 100 switch branches. The fleet view had been special cased inside the generic resource loading path. View-specific state was being cleared by manual nil assignments scattered through the file. Key handling depended on the current resource string. The same key meant auto-scroll in one view and shell into a pod in another. Structured Kubernetes data was flattened into positional string arrays, so the meaning of column 3 depended on remembering the column order somewhere else. One async handler even mutated render visible state from a background command. The writer's short version is sharp. AI writes features, not architecture. I would soften that slightly. A good model can implement architecture if the architecture exists and is enforced. It can follow ownership rules, respect typed messages, and split view state if the project already has that pattern. But left to the shortest path, it will often satisfy the prompt in the nearest place. The code gains another branch, another field, another string comparison, and another parameter. The code compiles, the feature works, and the cost moves into the next change. Shaw's maintenance math gives me a better test. The first week probably got faster. 7 months later, is the system cheaper to change than it would have been without the agent? In K10S, the answer was no, and the author archived the Go version and started rewriting in Rust, with the human doing the architecture first. The small companion piece today was All Things Smitty writing about positional Booleans, the classic true, false, true problem. A call that passes a user, then true, then false, technically works. TypeScript can tell you the values are Booleans. It can't tell the reader whether true means admin, whether email should be sent, whether validation should be skipped, or whether something else is going on without a jump to the function definition. The author puts it simply, he isn't reading code anymore, he's decoding it. That is the same maintenance story at the scale of one call site. Options objects aren't a grand architecture. Separate functions for separate actions won't win a design award. They are the little choices that decide whether future you can move quickly without a model rereading the whole code base on your behalf. The speed up only counts if the system you inherit is cheaper to understand, cheaper to test, and cheaper to change. The next cluster of items is about what happens when the agent isn't just writing a file and exiting. Eric Allam from Trigger.dev gave a talk called Two Roads to Durable Agents, Replay versus Snapshot, and it starts from a back-end history most web engineers know in their bones. For decades, the dominant shape was stateless compute. A request arrives, code runs, state lives in the database, and the process doesn't need to remember much. Then durable workflow engines arrived for multi-step side effects. Charge the card, send the receipt, resize the image. If something fails halfway through, you don't want to charge the card twice, so every step gets recorded and replay can skip the completed work. That replay model works well for workflows. Allam's point is that agents don't fit it cleanly forever. Once the large language model is orchestrating tools, every model call becomes part of a growing journal. Tool calls, tool results, and assistant responses pile into it too. A single turn is fine. Many turns start to stretch the log. A session that lasts hours or eventually days is different from a transaction. His line is that an agent isn't a transaction. It's a session. It lasts as long as the user wants it to last. The useful split in the talk is context state versus execution state. Context is the append-only record of what the model saw and said. System messages, user messages, tool calls, tool results, and assistant responses. That can live in a database or object storage. Another durable store works too. Execution state is the machine the agent is using. It may have cloned a repo and installed packages. It may have started a dev server, opened files, created subprocesses, and built up local state that can't be reconstructed just by reading a chat log. For that half, Allam argues for snapshot and restore. Save the machine, shut it down, and restore it when the next user turn arrives, or when a retry window opens. The numbers in the talk are useful because they pull this out of vague architecture talk. Trigger.dev previously used process checkpointing, then moved toward Firecracker micro VM snapshots. A naive snapshot of a 512 megabyte machine is 512 megabytes on disk. They compress and layer the snapshot, and he says they can get it down to around 14 megabytes compressed, with snapshots under a second and restores in the hundreds of milliseconds. He also says they are doing around 15,000 VM starts per minute in a benchmark. I wouldn't build a roadmap off conference demo numbers alone, but the design direction is clear. Long-running agents are pushing back-end teams toward recoverable machines, not only recoverable logs. Sally Ann DeLucia from Arazai hit the same class of problem from the context side. Their agent, Alex, analyzes trace data from AI applications. That means it's often analyzing the very kind of material that makes context grow, prompts and metadata. It also sees spans, conversation history, tool calls, and model outputs. They got stuck in a loop where Alex would run on trace and span data. The spans would grow, the context limit would hit, the agent would fail, and the failed attempt would add even more data. They tried the obvious moves. Naive truncation, taking the beginning and dropping the rest, made follow-up questions feel like new conversations. Summarization sounded sensible but was too inconsistent because the model couldn't reliably decide which details to preserve for later reasoning. Their working approach is more specific. They keep the head and tail, store the middle, keep the latest tool results, avoid resetting the system prompt, and let the agent retrieve stored context when it needs it. DeLucia phrases it nicely. Context decides what the model sees. Memory decides what survives. They also added long session evals, load 10 turns, test the 11th, and see whether the context strategy still works when the conversation has had time to decay. I like that, because late session breakage is the kind of bug you miss when you only test the happy first turn. A chat that feels smart for 5 minutes can become confused after 20 turns, and your users usually won't restart just because your context manager wants a clean slate. The Arise team also moved heavy work into sub-agents. Search over hundreds of spans doesn't need to live inside the main conversation. The main agent can keep the user thread lighter, delegate data-heavy work, and receive a result back. That isn't a magic pattern, but it's a practical one. If everything lives in one conversation, every task pays for every other task's intermediate mess. Put trigger.dev and Arise together, and you get a clean builder lesson. Durable agents need two forms of memory. They need a durable account of what has been said and done, and they need a recoverable execution environment for the work that can't be reduced to text. Save only the chat, and you lose the machine. Save only the machine, and you lose the reason the model was doing the work in the first place. The engineering problem is keeping those two histories aligned without making every turn more expensive than the work it's trying to perform. Mehdi Hassam from Granola gave the product version of the same lesson in a talk called You Can't Just One-Shot It. The setup is a meeting notes product with chat. You can ask questions about a meeting, across meetings, and across shared context. That sounds like the kind of feature the model vendors make look easy. Add the web search tool, call the model, ship the chat box. Hassan's examples are the problems you hit immediately after that. Web search looks like one line of code, but complex queries can blow up context and token cost. He mentions each chat costing around 10 pence in some cases, which doesn't sound like much until you have a large user base and people ask messy questions all day. Provider behavior can also change underneath you. He says they had been using a model for a while, then an overnight update degraded web search and the team had no direct control except switching providers. Output shape is another problem. A salesperson may want meeting notes organized around the deal. An engineer may want action items, blockers, and linear tickets. HR may want something else entirely. A single generic prompt isn't going to serve all of those people equally well. So Granola started building its own tracing tools, not as a purity exercise, but because the team needed to inspect tool calls and search behavior. They also needed reasoning, costs, and outputs in a shape that product, data, customer support, and engineering could all use. Hassan says their founder goes through the agent loop front to back to see what went wrong. That is a very different posture from treating the model as a sealed box and arguing with it through prompt adjectives. The other nice detail is their testing loop. Granola is an Electron app, which means local product testing has more friction than a normal web app. They split the render process so it can run as a web shell, then put preview links on pull requests. Now people can test variants without building the whole desktop app locally, and Cursor can test changes and upload screenshots into the pull request. Every desktop app doesn't need to copy that exact pattern, but AI makes variants cheaper. so teams need a faster way to feel and verify those variants. Otherwise, you have cheap generation and expensive judgment. All things Smitty's true, false, true essay fits here too. It's a tiny post compared with the enterprise announcements and security claims, but the craft lesson matches them. You can create an API that is fast to write and slow to read. An AI feature can be fast to demo and slow to debug. An agent loop can work on turn 1 and forget the user's intent on turn 20. The small local cost is the same kind of cost as the big system cost. Someone has to interpret what happened. Someone has to know which value means admin, which tool call blew up the context, which provider update changed behavior, and which view owns the state. So I'm getting more allergic to AI product demos that skip the inspection layer. Show me the trace and the eval that catches turn 11. Show me the preview link, the user role that changes the output, and the place the team looks when the answer feels wrong. A model can give you a surprising amount, but if the product has no way to see itself, the team ends up debugging through vibes. Granola's closing line says, "The answer isn't to one-shot better." That sentence fits today. Better one-shotting is nice, I will take it, but the builder advantage is in the loop around the shot. That means the typed interface, the trace, the preview, and the long session eval. It also means the handoff between context and execution, plus the human taste that decides when plausible code is becoming expensive code. The last item is a different kind of capability beat. Prince Kanuma from RC gave an AI engineer talk on MLX Gen Media, and the simplest description is Apple Silicon keeps getting more interesting for local multimodal AI. MLX is an array framework for Apple Silicon. It gives builders a way to run model work close to the metal on Macs, iPhones, and iPads. Kanuma says the ecosystem has more than 1.5 million downloads and over 4,000 ported models, with day zero support for open models from major labs. The talk is personal at the start. He talks about wanting to help his father read and navigate after losing his sight, and then connects that to on-device vision and audio. The demos move quickly. Object detection runs in real time on a Mac. Background blur works locally. A local vision language model can describe an image. The audio examples include text-to-speech, speech-to-speech, and a modular pipeline where you pick the speech recognizer, language model, and voice model. A small robotic setup uses local vision and audio too. There is also an on-device video generation example where a user chained generations together to make a more coherent story on a MacBook with 16 gigabytes of video memory. A couple of caveats. Conference demos are demos. The talk itself has a moment where a demo stumbles, which I appreciated because local AI work still has drivers and model files. Memory pressure and practical weirdness are part of the work too. Also, Kanuma is clear that you shouldn't expect a small local open model to behave like the strongest cloud model today. The local machine is becoming a serious creative surface again, even without parity on every task. The technical detail that stood out was Turbo Quant. Kanuma says it can reduce key-value cache memory by about 4 times, and he connects that to very long local context, depending on model and hardware. First reference, key-value cache is the memory models used to keep attention state around while generating. If you can shrink that without wrecking output quality, local long-context work becomes less ridiculous. That matters for the same reason the trigger.dev snapshot talk matters. Agent systems are hungry for state. They need context and files. They need tools, audio, images, and sometimes a running machine. Some of that will live in the cloud. Some of it's going to live on the laptop in front of you. I like ending there because it keeps the day from becoming only an enterprise deployment story or only a maintenance warning. OpenAI is building a company to embed engineers into large organizations. Security models are finding bugs and overclaiming some of them, while still changing the defender's toolkit. Builders are learning, again, that generated code has to be owned after it lands. Backend teams are building memory and recovery for agents that run longer than a request. Product teams are building traces and previews because AI features need observation as much as they need prompts. Local toolmakers are making the machine on your desk more capable than it was last month. The line I'm carrying into Tuesday is simple. Capability is exciting, but the code you keep decides whether the excitement survives. Lenar Kess.